Tonight's Shockwaves is sponsored by Vinegar Syndrome. Can you believe that it's only a week until Vinegar Syndrome's annual Black Friday sale, in which nearly everything in their catalog will be priced at 50% off SRP, with some titles going even lower? The sale will also mark the unveiling of Vinegar Syndrome's two limited edition surprise releases, which will include the world Blu-ray debuts of one of the wildest horror movies of the 80s and one of the most notorious cult film classics of the 1970s. Plus the Angel Trilogy box set and the incredible and totally uncut Tammy and the T-Rex, both on Blu-ray and 4K UHD. That's not all, because they're also re-releasing another duo of direct-to-video staples under the Video Syndrome Archive line, along with a ton of new shirts, posters, and other merch. But the only way to take advantage of these insane deals, along with even more awesome stuff we haven't told you about, is to visit www.vinegarsyndrome.com on November 29th through December 2nd. Again, that's www.vinegarsyndrome.com.
Welcome to episode 168. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Berserker fan, Elric Kane.
Alleged.
Is it Shockwaves approved?
I will clarify that later.
We're going to find out within the first 5 minutes of this episode. Also, potential Berserker fan, Ryan Turek.
Let's call myself on the fence. Berserker fan.
We'll get ready to pick a side.
Potential Berserker fan, Rebecca McKendry.
I'm ordering it right now.
No, you could just borrow it.
Oh, wait, can
right
I borrow
here.
This one? Okay, yes. I didn't know if this was someone's prize copy and they couldn't let Berserker leave their house. I will borrow this Berserker.
I don't know if
wait till we talk about it.
I don't know if I'd call it prized, but I mean, didn't you listen to your own ad? You could get it for 50% off.
I know, 50% off, but
actually, you can't borrow this. You have to buy it for 50% off.
I'm sure I will buy Tammy and the T-Rex. So.
Oh, boy.
Yes, yes that does.
That trumps Berserker for me.
Is it going to be in 4K or whatever the
hell I will take Tammy and the T-Rex in any format.
Any case you can get it.
Good.
All right. How's everyone doing?
Great.
Yeah. Excellent.
Ryan, you
I feel
you
changes
said you
in
had,
the air.
It's cold out there.
Yeah, it is cold.
I feel change. Oh, yeah, you're right. There is seasonal change. I feel
you,
that too.
Ryan, before we start recording, Ryan came into the room and said, I got shit to say while throwing down my copy of Berserker.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to say? Is it just about this or other things too? You have a lot
Isn't
to say?
Isn't this a song from
I think
Clerks?
I said, no.
Berserker.
Yeah, it is.
My love for you is like a berserker.
That just became a soundbite. Good job, Kane. Good job.
There's no Kevin Smith references.
Hey, Clerks is good.
There are no Kevin Smith references in this dojo.
Good 1997
All those porn titles are great at
there.
The start of that.
Yeah, Berserker is the biggest missed opportunity in 1987, y'all. I just...
Before you go on, let me just say one thing. I agree.
Wow.
Berserker, Jefferson Richards' directorial effort about a bunch of kids that go camping in the woods, and they think they're being...
Kids. Who knows
kids,
what they are?
20-somethings.
Quote marks. 30-somethings.
who think they're getting attacked by a bear, but what they are potentially being attacked by is a Viking warrior that wears bear clothing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he might have been transported into our time. But you know what? There's actually a big kind of like revelation at the very end that I don't want to give away. But
yeah,
let me just say, man, Buck Flower. In this film playing Pappy Nyquist.
Yeah.
And he talks with a
slight Swedish or
slight
Norwegian touch to it.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's actually doing
with
that
his
or
neck
if we
beard.
Just think, it's weird.
Well, the funny I mean, like,
but the opening minute,
well,
you're like, what kind of movie is this? This is exciting.
The opening minute is amazing.
Yeah,
and it's like a dude,
exciting.
It's like a Viking on a ship, and he's roaring, and he's wearing like the bear garb.
And then the title just comes exploding on,
and then you've got like a montage of fake bear and real bear imagery and blood on the fangs.
But what's funny is there's no body of water near Wisconsin that a Viking could get to. So it's really funny. I'm like, what, lakes? There's a bunch of lakes.
He had to walk across a couple states to get there.
So weird.
But listen, I mean, like, on a scale of Madman to the Prowler.
Wow.
Both films.
what a scale.
And these are both films that have fun concepts, but are really just movies about people walking around in the dark and not a whole lot happening.
Yeah.
This is kind of...
That wouldn't even get on that scale between those two. Those,
where do you
absolutely,
those are both great movies. Madman to the Prowler?
Where do you put it on your Microwave Massacre scale?
It's ahead of Microwave Massacre only because there's a sense of humor of Massacre that I really just did not go for me, but it's in terms of quality similar.
Well, look, let me go. But going back to the other scale, Madman and Prowler,
both are
very enjoyable films.
Yeah, they're both
but
fun.
Nothing happens for a good chunk of the time.
The Prowler has a pretty good kind of quality.
I'd argue enough happens in Mad Men.
But I'm talking about, again, you're missing
sweaty.
The point.
Yeah.
People walk around with nothing to do. There is no narrative. And this movie,
definitely for Mad Men, I totally agree. Prowler's a little more, but yeah.
I disagree with you.
What's
your
point,
after
Brian?
After revisiting the Prowler,
yeah, so you have a time shift.
So in this film, you have a pretty decent setup. You know, you got Pappy Nyquist and meeting these kids, and the kids going camping, and then they set off into the woods. Two kids go to have the sexy time, and then that's it. They walk around the woods for a very, very long time. Very long time. And then a bear attack happens.
Did they finish sexy time?
They finish it. Yeah,
well, there's two people having sexy time, and one guy starts playing his Get a Blaster, and they're all in the room together, and you're like, what the hell is this? One of the greatest.
Such a big
Yeah, he's one of the biggest dudes.
But then you get a pretty decent bear fight that I would say is just as enjoyable as seeing Leslie Nielsen versus a bear in Day of the Animals. Yeah.
The bear stuff is extra. It is that famous bear. It's the famous bear.
Bart the Bear? Wait a minute. It is Bart the Bear?
It is, yeah. Because I was watching with Dick, and he looked it up while we were watching.
You recognize him, outdoors? And you're like, I've seen that actor before.
Vinegar Syndrome's having a Black Friday sale. It is worth it for Bart the Bear. Support the bear.
Uncredited Bart the Bear.
Uncredited.
Well, what I noticed, too, I mentioned this on my Instagram, is that the guy who plays the cop in this is the first person that Rowdy Roddy Piper sees in They Live after he puts the glasses on. He's the guy that's standing by the newspaper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that guy.
Yeah,
and then
George
Buckflower is also in They Live.
Yes, he is.
A great role.
Yeah. So you get the John Carpenter connection, let that fool you. Berserker is an acquired taste. I don't know. You know, again, it's like there's another scale that I have, which is like the Vinegar Syndrome scale.
Yeah.
And you just really don't know what that discovery is going to be. Now, someone reached out to me and said, hey, by the way, I see that you're watching Berserker. You just need to immediately jump into Unmasked Part 25.
Because that's what I want to see.
You don't
that's
need
the discovery
to jump.
Of the year.
No, I want to see
it. I can't wait.
I need to rewatch it. I've had it on VHS for a long time. And when I found that at like a thrift store when I lived in New York. And I held on to it forever before I finally watched it. And I was not amused. But it was on VHS and it was overly dark. So I am excited to revisit.
I
want to
see that one.
I watched half of it. And it was really good. But I don't know why I didn't finish it. I was like, something came up and I had to get back to it, but it was very interesting, very British.
Oh, it's a British one. Okay.
It's almost like a British interpretation of a Friday the 13th sequel
that just
goes – it's very interesting. Hmm. That goes almost Phantom of the Opera style. Hmm. So I got to get back and finish it because it was – it might actually be one of their gems of this year for sure. Well, cool. Berserker. There you go.
How many stars? I know you don't star things on Letterboxd, but if you were, I believe you're a half star man for that one.
Did I give it a half star?
I think I gave it
a little better than that.
I'd give it 2 stars.
See, I understand why you don't Letterboxd like new films because of your job, but I don't know if you're ever going to run into someone who goes, Ryan, you gave my Berserker 1 star.
What? Until you wind up getting a text message at 3 a.m. from a filmmaker going, why did you give my film this Letterboxd score?
Yeah, no, I get it.
I'm never doing that again.
Yeah.
I gave Berserker 1.5.
Oh, that's generous.
Yeah,
okay.
There was
so
one,
I'm a half.
Well, y'all
I
just
give
fucking
it one,
sold me. Yeah. Can't wait to go home and watch
I
get, it.
I give it 1 whole star for a bear fighting a bear man.
Yes.
It's pretty good. All right. Let's see. What else? Because Ryan had just talked about it, I watched Hunt. Actually, all of you guys saw
it.
Yeah,
I saw Hunt. Mm-hmm.
I watched Haunt, which is now on Shudder. I know that might be weird because it's is it set on Halloween? I don't even know.
It was Halloween.
Oh, it's Halloween. Yeah. It's Halloween night. Okay, yeah. Halloween horror movie. From the guys that wrote A Quiet Place, mm-hmm. and they wrote and directed this, and it's basically a group going into a. It's funny because it's not really it's not an escape room and it's not a horror maze. Like
they call it extreme haunt.
They call it an extreme haunt, but it's not that either.
And that's the funny thing is because I've seen people that are into that culture, that are into the mazes and extreme haunts, being like, that's not what those are at all. But you get the gist that that's mm-hmm. it's people's approximation of that. And I think Ryan, actually, when you were talking about it, was saying that it has a great. Almost a great that's third
a,
act.
No, it's a great upswing. It starts okay, I think, you know, yeah. And then it kind of feels like you've been on this journey before, mm-hmm. but I actually found myself there's a turning point in act two where I was just like, oh no, I'm really getting into this.
Yeah.
And until it crescendos into the third act, I was like, oh, this is where the movie should have began. This is fantastic. Yeah. I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
No, it was. It was really cool. And I think that the gimmick behind you basically, you know, because it starts out the main character has kind of an abusive boyfriend, and so she decides to go out with her friends for the night, and, you know, Halloween, and just party it up. And then they just end up at this extreme haunt. And it's all pretty harmless for quite a while. And in fact, kind of like, oh, what we're seeing, is it real or anything like that? But then there's such a sharp turn, and there's such a cool reveal behind the people that are
mm-hmm.
running the thing that really hooked me.
Yeah.
I wish it was just a little bit more. I guess I agree with what you're saying. Is I wish it started with that, and then we really got crazy.
Yeah.
It's not a spoiler, but you don't get a lot of answers, and sometimes that's fine for a horror movie, and sometimes it's a little unsatisfactory. And I kind of want to just a little bit more, mm-hmm. backstory or history behind what is going on here, because it's such a cool hook and premise.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, it's a cool little haunt movie set on Halloween, and it's on Shudder right now. So I definitely think it's worth checking out. I was pleasantly surprised, especially by that third act.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was fun.
Yeah.
It's kind of like I kind of felt similar to Hellfest, last year's Hellfest, where the final 2 minutes of Hellfest, I was like, this is where I kind of wish this was the midpoint of the movie.
Yeah, I was frustrated by the setup of Hellfest. It took so long to get going of me going, God, just something happened. And then it became a chase movie, just like a stalk and kill.
Yeah, yeah.
And then at the end, I was like, oh, this just got good, and then it's done.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather Hellfest's canvas, but with those killers from Haunt, because the killers in Haunt are really cool, where it lands in the end.
It's just funny because they just all feel interchangeable.
Yeah.
Because it's like the same backdrop, spooky haunt.
Yeah,
it's like
a house
about the Hellfest.
That's almost its own subgenre at this point.
Yeah.
Hold on, what was the Hellfest killer called? It was even something completely
just
ambiguous.
Kind of like a stalker guy, right?
No, but he had a name that was like completely
faceless guy.
No, it wasn't
Mush
the other. That was it. No, it was just the other.
There was one thing about Haunt that I didn't really like, which is at a key point, and this isn't spoilery really, at a key point, the only person who you're kind of waiting, who could kind of wade into this and save the day is the abusive boyfriend. And so you're suddenly kind of sitting there going, I hope that guy in the truck comes and saves him. And you're like, wait a minute, he's the abusive asshole.
Yeah, you're like, I hope his stalking pays off in this one.
And it left me feeling kind of weird. I didn't really like that, but whatever.
Yeah, that was an odd choice.
But you know, it's a hard. Sometimes write yourself into a corner.
But it made me laugh. The payoff to that did kind of make me laugh.
Yeah, no, it was. Yeah, no, I was fine with it in the end. But
yeah,
it's
there
fun.
You go. Haunt. What else you got?
Let's talk about Adam's Family.
Yes. Yeah, so
you guys went, right?
We took the kids, our prospective broods, to go see Adam's Family on Saturday night because Marnie had been really wanting to see it. And Keaton came along.
A 5-year-old said, this is just for the parents, thought it looked a little too creepy in the trailers. And then when he's watching, he turns to me after, he's like, no, this isn't creepy at all. This is so funny. The imagery is really good. I didn't love this. I wanted more of the Addams Family.
Yeah.
And I think we all grew up on Addams stuff and the TV show. So I don't
TV show and the movies.
Yes. Yeah.
So how does this compare to the two movies?
So it goes completely different.
Different type of story.
You definitely spend a lot of time with these other their characters and then a little bit with the Addams family. Like, they treat them as the other people. So the setup of it is that it goes all the way back. Like, you get 2 seconds of a prequel, which I would have loved a prequel to the Addams family,
where
a little
chased
bit more.
Out of town.
Yeah. Like, and oh, so you get 3 seconds of Morticia and Gomez getting married, and then they're chased out of town, having nowhere else to go. They retreat to this abandoned asylum and up on a hill, and there's no one around them.
But surrounded by fog, so they think no one lives near them.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to what, 15 years?
15 years later, they now have the kids and they've been there forever. They wake up one morning and they discover that this kind of planned community is being built in the valley right beneath them. And it's all being run as part of this home improvement show. Like, this home improvement show has taken over the town.
What?
And is.
So it's like a Real Housewives of Atlanta kind of woman who's like the other main character. Who's
trying she's to supposed to be very kind of.
I didn't get any of this from the trailers.
No. I know, right? And so you spend the bulk of the movie in this kind of planned community with these normal people who are all like weirdos up on the hill. They're decreasing our home values.
Yeah,
and this like wench host woman who is supposed to be very much kind of like a Paula Deen. She's got this very kind of big hair and comes in and is like, we need to cheer up your house and put up some drapes and get you the hell out of here. And at the same time, Wednesday, what little we do get.
I like
of
Wednesday
it,
in this. I do think Wednesday's
fun. See, that's
fun
where I kind this. Of – I bucked even more. Yeah. Because Wednesday doesn't like her family. She wants to be a normal kid in it.
But that's
not Wednesday.
Exactly. Yeah, I was like, fun. Wednesday can't be like that. Wednesday has to own it and love it and be proud of it. But Wednesday like wants to be like a Girl Scout. And it comes back around. But
she's just rebelling against – it's almost saying whatever your family dynamic, you're going to rebel against it, which I liked. No, there's a, it's a perfectly good movie.
Yeah.
It just isn't – it just
it's not
falls
what
short.
We remember. Yeah. Yeah.
And some of the characters, the voices – do throw you because they just don't – it doesn't sound like Although Fester. It doesn't sound like Morticia to me.
Snoop Dogg is cousin. It was great.
Yes.
But that said, no, there were moments where I was like, man, I miss live action Addams Family because it was always so crazy and fun seeing them.
And dark.
And dark. And seeing them like, you know, stab each other with swords and do the – what's the big dance that they do?
The
sword dance that they do, which is still in there as like the family tradition.
Also, when did Gomez become – like kind of round?
Yeah,
that was an interesting choice.
Very,
I think of him as this very lean figure in the thing.
Who is the actor from the 1920s? Did M... why can't
Peter Lorre.
Peter
Lorre.
Yeah,
Lorre.
He looks very Lorre in this.
That's true.
Not
it's just a weird.
It's just
that was a strange design choice. Okay, the all star of this movie. The reason it's almost worth watching for Lurch.
Mm-hmm.
Like Lurch is so fun. How
he's
they treat
fun
him. He's basically a mental patient. They've run over.
They hit with their car and they literally put him in a tux and they're like, "Come with us. Can
and
you get our bags?"
And he's got some really funny moments in it, just that are surprising.
Yeah,
so.
He's great. But I missed live action Addams Family, but my kids have seen – they've seen the original TV show and they've seen both of the live action movies, but Marnie guffawed at this cartoon. And then we got home and she was like, can we watch it again? And I was like, not for like 2 months before it hits
VOD. But
that's
a good sign. So it may be a different generation. You know?
Interesting. Yeah. Well, and because of this one, the two movies came out on Blu-ray. Because I don't think both of them were on Blu-ray.
Yeah, and that's where she's seen them is we got those probably 3 weeks ago, and so we've watched both of them in repetition. And when little baby with mustache is like flying all over the place, my kids just freaking lose it.
Yeah, Addams Family Values, that sequel is great.
Oh, and there are a bunch of horror references in it that are like actually deep cut horror. One line. I can't remember one, but one I was like, wow, they're referencing something else.
I know that they asked for holy hand grenades at one point, and I was like, oh, that's a reference. But there were a couple others that hit me that I was like, that's kind of a deep cut. Good job, guys.
Some people will dig it, though.
Yeah.
Cool.
What else?
I finished American Horror Story.
It's over?
It's all done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does it land?
It does.
Oh.
It actually does. What was interesting is it lands on a very heartfelt note, which I didn't expect from a season in which basically, I mean, it all revolves around this camp. It kind of like goes outside the camp every once in a while, but it's basically about this camp. The kids who go there, I keep saying kids. The counselors, the proposed counselors go there in 1984. And basically you're kind of following Emma Roberts's character, and there's a lot of threads that connect her and Richard Ramirez, who becomes kind of a supporting character.
Richard Ramirez in a camping ground.
Yeah. Well, he follows her from Los Angeles.
Okay. Yeah. He's been part of prior seasons.
He was in Hotel, but this is a very different story thread. So they don't do any of the connective tissue to the other seasons. But but what you find out, and the spin that they put on the slasher subgenre, is that when you die at the camp, your soul is stuck there. So you're a ghost. You're a camp ghost.
So it's like Murder House at a camp?
A little bit, yeah. Okay. So you're a summer camp, you know, counselor ghost, and you can kill people. So that's basically what a lot of the angry ghosts do. And so you've got Richard Ramirez, you've got Mr. Jingles, who's the other slasher. But like some of the highlights of this season have been like, you see Richard Ramirez take on a slasher, and another slasher in a very kind of Freddy versus Jason-esque way. You've got the camp ghosts. You've got an element of the supernatural because Richard Ramirez worships Satan. Satan is actually imbuing him with his powers. There's a lot of fun stuff to it, and it jumps. The conclusion is very... There's a lot of threads, and they tie them up very nicely. I know it won't be for everybody because I know a lot of people's patience have worn thin with American Horror Story, but...
Is this the last season?
No. Oh, okay. No. But I really enjoyed it, and, you know, it definitely delivered in ways that I did not expect, and I think everybody, tonally, it stayed in line with what it began with, which was nice, because a lot of those other seasons kind of went off the rails and jumped and went in a whole different direction. I think it was like not American Horror Story Cult. American Horror Story Roanoke is like the biggest offender, where
the found footage season with
The one where they like went from found footage to like a full on like reality show concept.
Yeah. It was weird.
Oh, so bad.
And the plot needed a lot of work.
But it was very cool. Very, very cool. I saw some of the movies, but I'll get to those in a little bit.
So I rewatched Wreck because I was teaching a class on found footage, and at the end of it, I usually let my students kind of pick what movie they watch, or I'll base it off of what no one has seen in the class, and only one person had seen Wreck, so I showed that. And it was just so much fun to revisit and see some of the things that I did not necessarily notice the first time. The jump scares in that are so well orchestrated.
But you forgot the twist.
So Elric heard me ranting both in class and after.
Because the students were very unhappy about this twist.
I know.
What?
So the only...
What's wrong with
the
only...
Oh, no. You're going to hate this as well. They loved the movie.
Physical media story.
The only version available on Amazon, iTunes, Vudu, Roku, you name it, is dubbed. English dubbed.
Bad.
Horribly.
English.
Like to the point where they had
somebody... This is why physical media matters.
Somebody
doing... There is a Scream Factory box set.
Yeah. Which I have now got in my Amazon queue because I was like, I'm going to teach this again. Like, literally while I was in class, I put it in there. And I started it, and immediately we heard the language. And then I frantically stopped it, and I checked YouTube. I checked every media outfit. They were all the English dub. And so then I asked the students, I was like, do we keep going with this, or do you guys want to do something different? We can find a different found footage film. We can do one of the other choices I gave you. And they were like, no, we really want to keep going with this. And they did. And I will say that even in the shitty English dub, the jump scare still worked. But oh my god, there were parts of it that were cringeworthy, because like they're the laundry people, there's an Asian family that runs a laundromat or has the laundry facilities in there. They were the worst fake accents. It was like cringeworthy.
Peter Sellers doing the Asian.
It was awful.
Charlie Chan.
It was awful. Borderline racist, to the point where I was sitting in the back just like repeatedly like cringing.
It's just so
from
disappointing
it.
That's the only one. You would think there'd be multiple.
And so I have since added the Blu-ray to my queue, and we'll be picking that up before I show it again next semester. But yeah, that said, revisiting it was awesome. And something that I'd never paid attention to, once I started preparing a lesson on found footage, and I will probably make this an episode of an upcoming Nightmare University just because I'm so engrossed in them right now, I started paying attention to scores in found footage films and how quickly we kind of stop paying attention to scores and accept those. Like, we're watching this footage that is supposedly real and found, but we're cool when the strings kick in during jump scares and stuff like that.
Does Wreck has a score?
Wreck has a score.
Yeah, I don't remember that at all.
Wreck has
wouldn't it be funny if it's only the American
it's probably
dub?
Probably the American dub.
Well, I will say it at least had like an ending score and things like that. I didn't notice it prominently through the movie, but then I started researching what other found footage films have scores. Like As Above, So Below has a score. The Visit does not. The Visit has very little score. So I'm now kind of obsessed with whether found footage films score or not.
It is a weird thing to score something like that when you think about it.
Well, I think
it's interesting, though.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, I kind of I feel like if the found footage is presented and assembled fictionally,
oh yeah, then it makes sense because sound designer could have done
but,
it.
But I mean,
but stuff like Last Exorcism, I always like had a grievance with just because of the very orchestrated score.
Yeah, but I mean, you think Cannibal Holocaust has a score? So
yeah, but that's mostly movie. It's not all found footage.
It's not. Yeah, it bounces back and forth between the two. The one that I also revisited when I was preparing the lecture was Man Bites Dog, and I still greatly appreciate that, but God, that's a hard movie to get through.
It's funny.
Yeah,
it's so dark.
It is. And I mean, like, I was trying to explain it to the class as like, and the camera crew starts siding with the serial killer, and then it just goes from there. And even still, it's like, it's funny, but it was so abhorrent and hard to get through. But if you're looking for something rough, try Man Bites Dog.
Yeah.
But your review is for Wreck.
Yes, and do not but buy the Blu-ray or the box set. Do not rent the one on Amazon or iTunes or any of those. The dub is awful.
Ugh, that's a bummer.
It was on Netflix for so long as the Spanish version.
There must be a reason for that.
It's no longer on Netflix.
Yeah. And Netflix you could change because there was one movie, I think it was called like Blood Glacier. Yeah.
I liked Blood Glacier. That was Scandinavian?
Yeah, but I hear the English dub is terrible. Ugh. And it like defaults to that. But you can switch on Netflix, at least you could switch language and go to the original.
Yeah, so. I saw Blood Glacier at Fantasia in its native language and it was fun. I mean, like the CG was a little wonky at times, but it was a good movie.
Yeah. One that kind of like came out under the radar. I mean, obviously Scream Factory does a great job with all the retro titles, but they do new stuff occasionally. I just checked out their release, Itsy Bitsy.
Yay.
Which old friend of mine, Micah Gallo, directed, and an even older friend of mine, Jay Alvino, was one of the co-writers on it.
And I'll jump in and say one of my friends from college is the star.
Oh, get
Liz.
Out of here.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so, Elizabeth Roberts.
So, yeah, there's some good names in it. Bruce Davidson's in it. Denise Crosby. And it's just unexpected. Like, anytime you think of a spider horror movie now – like, I remember when I was young, Arachnophobia was great. Like, that was a great theatrical experience. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it since. I own the Blu-ray, but I haven't watched it in a really long time. But I think now, because we're so used to the, I don't know,
the sci-fi model.
The sci-fi model, you expect something like that. This is not that at all. And in fact, it's played very, very seriously, and it opens kind of on an archaeological not a dig, but like it's archaeologists and investigating and stealing this I don't know if you'd call it a totem or just like it's shaped like an egg and it's got all these symbols on it or whatever, but it's basically has to do with some sort of ancient spider thing. And so this gets stolen and eventually delivered to Bruce Davidson's character, who's a former archaeologist, now kind of an invalid living on his own. And then the main character is a mother of two who has had some substance abuse problems and moves to this town specifically for this gig to take care of this guy. And I can't remember exactly if it's part of the curse of him getting the thing or if the kid knocks it over, but basically they disrupt this totem and a little spider thing comes out of it. And it's all practical. Hmm. And so slowly but surely, like, it eats a rat that's in the house. And then it slowly starts getting bigger. And you just, you know, there's webs and just, like, gook and, you know, all sorts of cool stuff.
It's really good practicals.
Yeah, it's very, very good practical stuff. And it's also kind of a slow burn and really more of a – it's more about this family dynamic and drama than anything. And then it just builds and builds until this thing is ginormous. And again, I appreciated that it was just a very contained family drama that happens to have a creature in it. Mm-hmm. And not like a CG creature, a freaking creature that's really gross. So I don't know. I thought this was a really pleasant surprise. It came out – I think they put it out on VOD a couple of months ago, but it's now officially on disc. So I got the Blu-ray of it, and I think it's on DVD as well. And yeah, I mean it's in that vein of Arachnophobia, not as big stars or anything, but it's really, really cool. Itsy Bitsy.
Cool.
Strongly recommend
it. I'll have to check it out. It's on my queue.
Yeah.
You guys know how I feel about the first half of Knock Knock. I love the
where
first half
going?
Of Knock Knock. I don't like where it lands, but I like the first half.
Where are we going?
And it made
this?
Me curious.
About?
For years, I've been wanting to see the original film that it is a remake of.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's very hard to find. And it's not available
what
in many
it
places.
Was it,
called Death Game.
Death Game.
1977. Yeah. And the video store that I keep telling people to go to Video Vortex at the Alamo has a copy.
Oh.
So I rented it for last week. This film is excellent. And it pushes, it's a really edgy, really lot of sex. really quite disturbing movie.
Is it basically the same?
It's
premise,
almost exactly or? The same, but where Eli is kind of going, maybe there's a little bit more comic. Like, I really like the first half and the setup with the girls in Canada. And this one feels more like a Lost Manson girl. They feel like Manson girls. They feel really dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
It's basically Sandra Locke, who was married to Clint Eastwood.
Oh, wow.
And Colleen Camp from the Police Academy films.
Yeah, yeah. The poster looks really like Faster Pussycat.
Yeah, they're the two girls. But what's crazy is
I was going to say Colleen Camp also produced Knock Knock.
That's yeah. right. That's yeah. right. And she yeah. appears in it in some small, right, small, small. Yeah. Small thing. But she's really good. No, they're both like super young. They basically – it sets up Seymour Cassell, who's the kind of – it's a curveball at being Seymour Cassell because if you know, he's in Cassavetes movies. But the really shocking part of this, and it really threw me, is they dub him. And it's brutal because Seymour Cassell
weird.
Has a really strong yeah. accent. Somebody made a decision probably back then like, oh, we can't sell this movie the way he sounds. So he's just dubbed in the most generic, hi, I'm a white man. That's what it sounds like. And it's crazy because he's the only one being dubbed. So it's Sandra Locke's voice. It's Colleen Camp's voice. But he's being dubbed and it must have been a choice. And if you are familiar with Seymour Cassell, you would see him also in Wes Anderson movies. He's just got a very specific cadence to his voice. And I was sitting there the whole time going, oh, I can only imagine how much more interesting this would be with him. But he plays this it's really like he's like loving husband in the opening scene. They seem so close and his wife goes away. And then he's going to be stuck at home for a while. He's a successful – I can't remember what his job is. And basically these two girls are totally soaked. It's pouring outside. They have come to the wrong house. They ask to stay there. They slowly seduce him. It takes a little while because he is pretty resistant. And then – they all spend what seems to be, you know, a good night all together.
Does
basically.
He scream it's free pizza? No,
there is a free pizza line, but it's a little more. There is pizza though. He does offer the pizza. It's kind of amazing.
We're keeping the pizza.
They're keeping the pizza line, but what's weird? It's what's interesting. This one felt more motivated. I never really understood in Knock Knock like why they were doing it, but like basically not so much the why. It's still meant to be unmotivated and random and scary in that way. But like, you know, he spends this night and they're like, oh, no, we want to stay with you. And he's like, no, you have to get the hell out. This is over. And they just feel a little more desperate. They feel way more unhinged. Sandra Locke, there's a couple moments where she actually freaks me out. Like she's got this very intense look. Mm. And it just goes to a darker, more disturbing – because it's always grounded in that 70s kind of style of exploitation film. It's definitely not there for – there's very little humor in this one. Whereas I find what I like about Eli Roth is actually that's quite funny. And I think the back and forth – Keanu I think is really good in it. Like,
yeah.
I just think where it ended that one, it just took me out a bit. But I just do it, you know. But this one I think is a lot more interesting for horror fans. And I think it's worth seeking out. I'm not sure how hard it will be to find if it wasn't for Seymour's voice.
They've got a DVD of it under the title The Seducer. For $9.
Yeah, so be careful just in case it's a shit, you know, it could be really. Even the DVD I watched
wasn't
the best
quality.
Yeah, this
is from a company called Synergy that I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, it's probably out of print. It's, I mean, like, that probably exists, but it's probably a company that doesn't even exist.
Yeah, it's
but,
a 2009 release.
But a good double feature for you Keanu fans.
There's used copies of Death Gamer out there too on DVD.
It is a weird one to want to remake because it is. It also feels, and also other cool thing, it's a really cool San Francisco film. It's like every angle of San Francisco is really about that area, which I don't think Eli's was. I can't remember where that one was set, but I kind of understood the motivation. I think this actually, if I was programming the new Bev with all those Once Upon a Time, I would pair this because it feels like a Home Invasion Manson girl thing.
Yeah.
Whereas I never felt that in Knock Knock. They just seemed like a couple pretty girls walked into your house. These girls feel like of that time. Like,
yeah.
I believe it a little
bit. I dig these eyebrows on one of them.
Yeah, she paints. They paint their face pretty creepy shit stuff going on there.
Wow.
So that's Death Game.
1977. So
if two girls come to your house and want to sleep with you, it's too good to be true. Move on.
This is like when we actually need like a video camera for the faces I throw to Ella. He's like, Keanu Reeves is really great in this. And I'm like,
you should have seen Ryan's face.
I love Keanu, but I don't know.
He's really good.
Well, while I was gone, Shout Factory, Scream Factory released the best box set in the world that said, Ryan Turek, this is for you, and it's the Omen Collection.
Ooh, oh, yes.
This is correct.
Now, it's a very complete box set because it comes with Omen 4.
Yeah.
And it comes with the Fox remake of The Omen.
Yeah. Got them all.
So now I have them all, for better or for worse. But I am a wearing my heart on my sleeve, tried and true fan of the Omen trilogy. I adore this trilogy. What, like, the way, like, my wife loves true crime, and I fucking love the mythology that weaves itself in and out of the Omen movies.
Is three Sam Neill or is two Sam Neill?
Three is Sam Neill. So basically,
I can't remember two at all. I gotta watch these.
Great.
Sacrilege.
Yeah,
I do not remember
sacrilege. Yeah. No, the original Omen is just a great. It's just a great film. Richard Donner, you know, I mean, like, there's so much said about it. And all I can say is just, like, it's a great setup. And when we were watching it, I was like, I'd love to do side stories, like what's happening behind the scenes. Because what you discover if you really watch the film closely, and Donner either made this intentional or not, but there are many scenes in which Gregory Peck is walking through a scene and you see, like, an extra and you're like, they're in on it. There's, like, you know, there's, like, a very suspicious woman, and you're like, oh, she is in league with the fucking devil, and she knows what's going on. There's a moment when he's, after he finds out that his child had died, and the priest is about to do the old switcheroo, there's, like, a guy that is, it's after the baby's born. He's in Italy, and there's this guy mopping the floor of the, you know, of the building. I'm like, that guy is in. He's just like, you got the devil's kid. There is just so much charm and to just the filmmaking of it all. I mean, like, Donner is just bringing out, like, his craft and composition and color and all of that stuff. And what I also appreciate about The Omen is that there are two faces to the movie. There is the kind of sinister, creepy kid film, like, for the first half, and then it becomes like a procedural investigation type movie when Gregory Peck and David Warner, who plays a photojournalist, they team up together, and then they start, like, globe hopping. They're like going
maybe
to different
your kid
cities.
Is the devil? Let's go find
Let's
out.
Let's go find out. And they go on this investigation. They're like, they're literally digging up graves and getting attacked by dogs together. And I'm like, you know what? I kind of want to live in this world for a little bit longer and have these two just, like, team up and solve supernatural shit. And then you've got the Damien the Omen 2, which finds Damien at the age of 13. He's at a military academy. Lance Henriksen's his teacher.
Can we look that up as we go?
Yeah. It's
I'm gonna guess J. Lee Thompson does one of these, but J. Fury or someone.
Hang on, let me just pull it up really quick.
Just two and three. I'm curious.
No, three is Don Taylor. Oh. But IMDb also says Mike Hodges, uncredited.
Get Carter.
And this is where, like, the Omen becomes a lot more outrageous. Yeah. It takes this very...
That's a good word for it.
Yeah, it takes this very classy concept from the first movie and then kicks it up tenfold. You literally open with the with Bugenhagen, who's the exorcist that they go visit, and suddenly this guy's performance, like, goes super big. In the first movie, he's just like, listen, okay, your kid's the devil. You got to stab him with these daggers. I know it's going to be difficult, but you got to eradicate him. And then he's like super, super subdued, real nuanced performance. By the beginning of the next movie, he's like, fucking Damien killed his parents. You need like we need to go and get more daggers and we need to do this thing. He's like playing it really big. And then with the death of this guy and his buddy, as they get buried alive in this like catacomb, the score kicks in. It's super big. It's much bigger than the first movie. And what you discover is Damien is now at a military academy. He's living with his uncle. And this is basically like a story of a teenager finding his destiny. And it's kind of tragic.
Yeah.
Because,
that's really cool.
Because, you know, at first when he's like living at home and before he goes on to school and he's living with his cousin and stuff, you know, he's got this this relative who frowns upon him, is like, you know what? She tells like Damien's cousin, she's like, you should stop hanging out with him. He's trouble. She's got this like sense. But Damien seems like a cool kid. He's like, he's got wit about him. He's very funny. He's very smart. But once he gets to school, this shit gets triggered and he starts to realize his powers. And when someone in his family that is very near and dear to him dies, it's incredibly tragic when he's responsible for it. And this kid, what's his name? Jonathan Scott Taylor,
Jonathan Scott Taylor is
not
Damien. No,
Jonathan Scott Taylor. It's not who you think it is.
Oh, okay.
No, 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 no. It's not not the teen beat, yeah, whatever his name
that's
is.
That's what I was thinking.
No. And it's a really strong performance from this kid. And there's great death. The deaths are amplified. So you got a woman who dies by a crow. Not only does she get attacked by a crow, but she gets hit by a truck, gets flown over the cab. So she hits the actual trailer,
yeah,
falls between the trailer and the truck cab, and then gets run over.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first one has one of the greatest on-screen deaths ever.
Oh, yeah. The plate
of
glass.
So from that,
yeah,
they're like, all right, how crazy can we get in the sequel? Yeah. And I got to tell you, there's two things I wanted to tell you. One, the last time I saw this was on the big screen, double bill at the New Bev, Damien the Omen 2 and Jaws 2.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Oh,
both
wow.
came out in 1978. Both are bonkers in their own way, yeah, and they're both like the perfect sequel. It's a perfect double bill.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It was so much fun.
Yeah, because I mean, good. Like they're both films that are obviously starting to try to stay true to their origins, but they just embrace this kind of like there's something much larger about their nature. They're like abandoning the what made their movie classy, yeah, and just being just pure
going
crazy,
for it.
Just going for it. Yeah. And here's some insight into Halloween. I mean, like it's on his IMDb, so whatever. But with Halloween Kills, I hate to be dropping that. One of the greatest pleasures was working with Nicholas Pryor, who is actually in Damien Omen 2. And he came in and he auditioned for us. And when he left the room, I turned to David and I said, "That's fucking Charles from Damien Omen 2. That is like the family friend." And he goes, "No way." And then we looked him up, and he's also in Risky Business. He's in a bunch of movies. So when he shows up on set, the first thing, I mean, like, obviously we had conversations for hire, but I was like, "Look, I'm going to confess, I fucking love Omen 2. And he goes, "Oh dear." He was like, "That movie." And I was like, "No, man, I take immense joy from that film. I think it's like poetry. I think it is like a lot of great drama to it." And he's like, "Oh, all right. All right, cool."
Nicholas Pryor? You mean the father from Morgan Stewart's Coming Home?
Oh, my God, that's him?
Yes. Or, you know what? He's also in Dr. Sleep.
Wait, what is he
really? Yes, he's the old guy.
He's the old guy with the cat.
Yes. Yeah. I did. That was happening, I was like, "I know that guy."
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was, yeah.
Yeah, I had to text Flanagan. It was like, "We both work with Nicholas Pryor now."
Now, have you seen the Damien TV show?
No. So let me tell you why. I'll wrap up Damien. Damien Omen 2 is fucking fantastic. We're going to get into the final conflict with Sam Neill later this week, and I'll report back on that. But I fucking love these movies. What I love about Damien Omen 2 is they elevate the drama by creating more political intrigue. In the first movie, it's like the Antichrist will rise through politics. No kidding. And then in the second one, it's like how he'll rise through politics, which is corporate greed and other shenanigans. So you start adding in these other narrative layers that are about the thorn industry and how that has such a great impact on the world. And strangely, the thorn industry logo looks like Trump.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Anyways, it's fucking great. I love it. A reason why I didn't watch the Damien TV show is because I stupidly, when I was running the podcast, when I was doing it with Clark Wolf, I pitched my own Damien television series on air.
Yes.
And then I just stupidly put that out into the world. And then then 2 years later it became, I'm not saying that they fucking listened to the Bloodcast, but I was just so mad about it that I was like, I don't even want to touch it.
Well, I will say it's really quite good. I was really bummed that they canceled it after the first season.
I thought it was a missed opportunity, but I didn't finish it. I watched.
They adapted Ryan's stuff really well.
I will say,
it was faithful to your pitch.
The first episode did not rope me, but the second episode I was in. And
What age is he at?
So he is probably in his 20s. He's a war photographer.
They fucked it up.
They really did. Well, you know what's funny? Because they did the thing that now is popular, where it's a sequel only to the first movie.
Yep.
So 2 and 3 doesn't happen in the show version. It's just yes.
Oh my God!
But
no,
they don't do it right.
Oh no! It needed to be
present day. He can't be 40. You're like, wait, he's 20 and he's a war photographer now. That doesn't make.
Oh, yeah, you do between 2 and 3. That's the series.
Yeah,
it's him. It's after 2 ends.
And I will say they did do some cool stuff with it, because at this point in his life, he's a war photographer. He has completely forgotten about his past and all this other stuff. And then these people start kind of coming into his life very gradually, which is why, you know, you got to get the first episode. I was like, nothing's happening. And then the second I was like, oh, I see where they're going. Mm. These people start coming into his life kind of with this. It's time. It's time now for the apocalypse. And so you kind of get this bleeding in of the evil. But I was bummed. I was bummed it only lasted a season.
Let me just say the final conflict is on his IMDb Pro. Or IMDb rating, and it's got a 5.6 out of 10. That's fucking shenanigans right there. That shit is easy.
I remember that VHS cover as well as any other
VHS. Well, the funny thing is the VHS cover, you know, it says The Final Conflict, and it's got, you know, Sam Neill on the cover. It doesn't enunciate very clearly that it is an Omen movie. Yeah. So whenever I saw it, I was like, oh, what's The Final Conflict? Yeah. And I would actually have the video store clerk go, well, that's the third Omen movie. And I was like, interesting.
You know, that whole season is $4.99 on Amazon.
Yes, it is.
Of Damien. Yeah. Might be worth another shot.
You know what? I'm gonna probably watch. I've never seen Omen 4. I'll revisit the Omen remake.
I'm curious to hear what you think about that.
I liked the remake
now.
At the time. I had fun with the remake.
Yeah. It wasn't.
I thought it had
I
some good casting.
I don't remember hating it.
It's still
and I hated
some of those
a lot
key
of
moments.
Remakes.
Yeah, whoever played the nanny was really good.
Mia Farrow.
Oh, in the remake?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that part was really.
That was
good.
Like their stunt casting. Yeah. They're like, we've got Mia Farrow.
Yeah. I remember thinking it was okay, but it's basically what Psycho was, but like done kind of okay. Like it's basically shot for shot. It's pretty close.
But it's not like where Psycho loses. He's trying too hard to.
Yeah.
But I remember where they like riled people up as they included footage from 9/11 in the opening credits.
Yeah. Were you in New York too? When I was at that screening where. Somebody yelled at him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There was like a scene at the show.
I don't know. I just think I like that the Omen has a legacy. I think it could still go on if tackled the right way. What it dawned on me is because this is a Fox movie, now it's a Disney movie. So now Damien is a Disney prince.
Whoa. Nice.
Nicely done.
Him and Rocky Horror. Frankenfurter is a princess, so we got
the one last thing I want. I don't know if I've ever told you this, Ryan, but you mentioned the score. Jerry Goldsmith does all the
Jerry
scores.
Goldsmith,
And what's cool about it is he doesn't just recycle the theme. Like, all three movies have incredible scores.
Yeah.
And so I think Mondo might have re-put out the first one, but I always like to get original issues if I can. And so I was shopping in Burbank, and I found a sealed copy of the original Omen soundtrack.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, I got to get this. Yeah. And so I picked it up, and this is the fun of being in Cali. I get up to the counter, and the guy at the counter is like, oh, you know, this is Gregory Peck's copy. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I bought this from the Peck estate. Like,
what?
And he never opened it.
Proof.
Well, that's it. He was just like, I bought all his records off of his family.
That's so
and this
weird.
This is literally from his. I just put it out. I'm like, oh, great. Well, now it's mine.
And now you're opening it.
And I was like, I'm so glad that he thought so highly of the movie that he never opened his copy of the soundtrack.
Wow. I like, out of the three, I mean, I like the original Omen score. I think Goldsmith 2 is very good, but 3 is where he hits it out of the park. There's some just grand themes, and it's just so big and orchestral, and it just screams the end of a trilogy.
Yeah. I got to get this box out.
Oh, I fucking love it.
Cool.
Well, guys. I saw Dr. Sleep.
Yeah. Oh. Did you go too?
I saw Dr. Sleep.
Everybody know? Good.
Well, yeah, we're ready to talk Dr. Sleep.
Yes, right. Let's talk Dr. Sleep.
So now, well, we can start with the Shockwaves Approved, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
I think that's
definitely.
Easy.
Shockwaves Approved. Cool.
In general, I think this is like a really fun, beautifully crafted movie.
Mm-hmm.
I really like it. The parts I love... So the parts I love are the new thing.
Yeah, that I felt the same.
The soul vampire stuff is so compelling. I mean, if, you know, obviously now I understand why some people are getting so upset.
Mm-hmm.
It has one of the true most kind of horror intense moments I've seen in a long
time.
Yeah,
that was
to do with the kid.
Really hard to watch.
Pretty graphic. So,
hard to watch, but really important that we keep horror hard occasionally, especially in things that are go wide, you know, so we can remember why we have to feel these poles, you know, the push and pulls.
Right.
But I thought that sequence was brilliant. I think everything with the hat, what's
Rose the Hat.
Rose the Hat,
she
that whole mythology
phenomenal.
Is brilliant. And it's super compelling.
So much so that I wanted more from her because she's talking about, like, my fucking brain's a cathedral. I was like, can we see that, please? I wanted more.
No,
to
I am
know
curious.
More about
I am
her
curious
history.
About her back at the store. But so I just loved everything. Everything I didn't already have a callback, I loved. And then he does a brilliant job of connecting. Don't get me wrong. It's like so well done. I'm just like it's the problem is Kubrick's film, I guess to me, is super personal just because it is the film that made me a fan of movies in general, not just horror movies. But it's also not a movie. It's like it's a movie, but it's also this weird art thing that Kubrick's achieved, and it's so hard to when somebody else is replicating scenes from it. It's just like the narrative.
It gave
so
it feels it plot.
A little yeah. It feels a little bit more like a not a. If, well, we've also seen these characters dressed up so many times for Halloween for the last 40 years yeah. that there's moments. Shelley Duvall, not the Alex Esso completely nails. That character
oh my God, she
never
was
feels
so
like that.
Good.
Even her run in
oh, it's
yeah,
hilarious.
It was so good.
But there
good.
Is something about some other character when they pop in. Some of it's really fun in that way. But it for me, was just, it was more like, okay, great job. But I'm a little less excited about that stuff because to me, especially the one I don't want to see pop up in that way, in a sense, because it almost feels like a misunderstanding of that ghost is the woman in the bathtub. Mm. Because what that is about to me is it's much more about sexuality and it's about – in some ways, it's like, oh, Jack meets a beautiful woman, and in front of his eyes, she ages into this old hag, which is how he also views his wife in the story. And so it's really about marriage and about sexual attraction, and now it's just reduced to an old hag popping up to a little boy, and the old hag has nothing to do with a little boy. Like, she only is that way, I think, to Jack's character. This is just my reading The Shining. So that was some of that pop up. It's not bad. It's great. They make for great ghouls. I think how that's all wrapped up at the end is with one of the characters, kind of the climax, is brilliant. Like, there's a great use of that. But in terms of it has a lot of motion, and so it's he does a great job of making you care, and that's the difference. Like, Kubrick's version is not about caring.
No.
It's a very cold movie. It is much more about artistry and pulling you in along
exactly.
for a ride.
Exactly. And I was thinking about this after we saw it, when I think, like, what is the plot of The Shining? And I literally can just say, well, this family goes to the Overlook, and then he goes insane. And then he tries to kill everybody. But, like, what is the minutia that happens in between? I can give you choice scenes, but there is not necessarily, like, a plot.
There's
no arc.
It's
more of a progression.
It's always been famous for not having an arc.
It has no arc.
Because he's already crazy.
Right. Yeah, from the get-go. It just comes to the surface. This one clearly had more of a plot. And as we mentioned at the beginning, like, I wanted more of some of the characters, which it obviously could not be because we have to end at the Overlook. But, like, I want an entire movie about Snakebite Andy. The girl at the beginning in the movie theater, I want an entire movie of her. And,
yes, she was a really good character, like, in terms of, like, pulling me in to want to know. But I think this is a positive, like, that my favorite parts are new things, and that Flanagan's just absolutely at the top of his game as a horror filmmaker.
God, yeah.
That's a good thing. It's not a bad, like, the whole movie's great, but, like, it means I can't wait for that next strand of the original thing
that he does. I want to go back to the theater just to see it again because I just want to experience Rose tracking that girl over the country.
That was
like,
she's
Rose
just perfectly flat.
Flying over,
so,
like,
gorgeous.
That
it takes bold risks like
just,
that.
Oh, God. I mean,
really
visually
surprising.
Just masterful. Like, I just absolutely love that scene. I just sat there with my jaw open going, where is this going? And then once you see the encounter, I was still picking my jaw up off the floor. I was like, okay, not only have you given us a great travel moment, but now there's, like, a standoff. And I was like, holy crap, Mike. Jesus, this is so good. But you're right about Alex, because there's a moment when Alex is running out of the gas station and she's like, Danny.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that was pretty spot on.
No, there's a flashback of him chopping his way into the bathroom and you see a flash of her in the corner. And I had to turn and say, is that Alex? Like, because we knew that it was Alex going in, but that one shot looked so not Alex. So, yeah, just absolutely breathtaking.
The part I got most excited about was seeing the real Danny as a cameo. So little boy,
and
the only reason I know
game.
That, because he looks nothing like he did as kid, is because we met him in Texas Frightmare, and I sat down and had a conversation with him a few years ago, and to me it was like that was the biggest celebrity I've ever met, because it's somebody who, when I was young, the rumor was he was a little kid in The Shining, and then he walked off into a forest and no one ever saw him again. And there was a rumor for like a good 20 years that he did not, it turns out he just became a science teacher in Iowa and never acted again.
So he
but he gets to, he plays at the baseball
game when the True Knot are stalking the little kid. They're there watching. He says something like, see that kid, he's going places. That guy's
got the goatee. And
I
got so excited. I was like, oh my God, that's the real guy.
He's fine at all.
It was just a nice callback, but there is a lot. I think it will be a fun film to revisit, because there's so much taken, and you're going, and you really don't know where it's going, which is the best kind of storytelling. I don't know where this is headed.
Well, look, I mean, like, here's the thing. I mean, it's already a win if you wind up getting a horror movie into a theatrical release, because you're up against so much. And in this day and age where there's so much content and streaming and theater trying to vie for your attention, I was just thrilled to be walking out of a movie and going, okay, when are we going to go back and see that again? Because I want to re-experience certain emotional moments. And there's a great moment with Ewan McGregor where he has to make a very hard decision while he's by himself in his attic bedroom. And I just sat there going, oh, please. I wasn't familiar with Dr. Sleep. So I didn't know where it was going to go. And I knew it could go in one narrative direction if he had chosen one path, but he chose not to. He fought his own demons. And it was just silence.
Oh, that's a great
scene. Silence. Yeah. Ewan McGregor acting his ass off and a bottle. And that was it. And I was like, fuck, man, don't go there. Don't go there. And I just want to see that again. You know?
I also love when you can see in an artist like from film to film, like I saw how important Haunting of Hill House was to this movie making sense and working. Because I think Haunting of Hill House is like a masterpiece. I probably like it even a little bit more in terms of just craft personally. But I see all the things he's pulling off and that he's brought to this. Yeah. And he's taken that next step. And I think that's really great.
Well, you know what's interesting is like I think it was our mutual friend Josh Miller had posted a thing about how this Dr. Sleep seems like the perfect movie, everything involving about it would have been the perfect movie to debut on Netflix. Mm. And I disagree. I was like, well, no, I mean, that's kind of what the last three things Mike did were for that.
No, that's a big screen.
This is a big screen theatrical movie. No,
it's totally a big canvas what he's going for. And it is relating to Shining, which is definitely a big screen film. So you want to see it that way. Yeah. But so definitely approved. Definitely
Shockwave
like it.
It is approved.
Yeah, I feel like it's going to keep processing, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's so much
I couldn't. I mean, days later, I'm sure Ryan's the same. I can't stop thinking about it.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many things about it. It's so dense that I just keep thinking back to.
So I went home and started researching all the different members of the True Knot because I wanted to see, like, they all have wiki pages. And I wanted to see what information was available in the book that I had not been able to ascertain from the movie. And there's a good bit, like, they all have mythologies behind them. Mm. So, yeah, it's one of those. I definitely wanted more.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Good job. So really see it while it's still in theaters.
Definitely.
So people will stop writing articles about how it's failed.
Oh, my gosh.
So we can stop reading this bullshit. Who cares about how much money it makes for Christ's sake?
Go see it.
All right. Well, we have a cool guest tonight.
All right.
So let's bring him on after a word from our sponsor.
Tonight's Shockwaves is sponsored by Vinegar Syndrome. Can you believe that it's only a week until Vinegar Syndrome's annual Black Friday sale, in which nearly everything in their catalog will be priced at 50% off SRP, with some titles going even lower. The sale will also mark the unveiling of Vinegar Syndrome's two limited edition surprise releases, which will include the world Blu-ray debuts of one of the wildest horror movies of the 80s and one of the most notorious cult film classics of the 1970s. Plus the Angel Trilogy box set and the incredible and totally uncut Tammy and the T-Rex, both on Blu-ray and 4K UHD. That's not all, because they're also re-releasing another duo of direct-to-video staples under the Video Syndrome Archive line, along with a ton of new shirts, posters, and other merch. But the only way to take advantage of these insane deals, along with even more awesome stuff we haven't told you about, is to visit www.vinegarsyndrome.com on November 29th through December 2nd. Again, that's www.vinegarsyndrome.com.
All right, welcome back. We have a very special guest in the house, W. Earl Brown. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Earl and I met way back when I was doing a little documentary called Still Screaming.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
The scary, the Scream trilogy documentary that I did with Anthony Massey. And then strangely, I was on a plane flying out to Wilmington, and there was a very kind gentleman sitting in the aisle across from me, and I was reading a script, and he leans over and he goes, "What are you reading?"
Well, I said nice tats.
Oh, you said nice tats.
I know,
first
of all, I noticed the Halloween
the pumpkin,
tat. And I'm like, oh, fuck, that dude's like serious. And then I saw the Jason tat on the other arm.
And then he was like, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, I'm reading the script called Halloween Kills. And he was like, oh. And then I looked over and I was like, holy shit, it's Earl. Anyways, it was great to reconnect with you. And when we were down in Wilmington, you were down there shooting Reprisal.
Yeah.
Which was the other big show that had taken up the Screen Gems lot down there. And Reprisal is hitting Hulu on December 6th.
Mm-hmm.
I still can't – I saw the trailer for it. It looks like a tale of revenge.
It is. People ask me about the show. It's really hard to describe.
I know. I'm trying to figure it out myself.
It's kind of a film noir. It's a revenge. It's a woman left for dead a decade ago by an outlaw gang and – she's back.
Yeah.
And she's back with blood on her mind.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good description.
And this, which one of the platforms is this?
Hulu.
It's Hulu. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And it's Abigail Spencer plays, she's the lead.
Yeah.
And it's highly stylized. It's kind of an alternate universe. It's very much like a graphic novel, except it's not. It's based on original material.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's these three rival gangs. I even asked Josh when we started, I said, what's the tagline to this or a log
like
line,
a one line.
Or, you know, what's a log line of this? And one of the Hulu execs was there and he goes, you had to fucking ask me that question now.
just for you listeners out there, if you look at this actor's body of work, I mean, it stretches
Deadwood.
Back. I mean, there's, I mean, beyond that, I mean, like, yes, Deadwood is such a big
so
part.
Much,
yeah.
I'm
there's
dying up
so
here.
Much. And,
yeah. So, it was such a good show.
I loved
it. It was such
here.
A good show.
Loved
something,
it.
There's something about Mary, mm-hmm. you know, all the way back to, like, you know, I didn't even realize Backdraft.
Yeah. That was my first gig.
Amazing.
I'd finished school in Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly out of theater school and the real world hits you square in the face. And I auditioned for that film and I worked on the renovation crew because when I was a student there at DePaul, I couldn't really afford it. So I had to work. And all the local Chicago guys, you know, the plumbers and the electricians,
they were
busting my chops constantly. Hey, actor boy. Hey. So I started mocking them. And so anyway, I went into Backdraft with that dialect,
right.
And Ron says, "So, well, obviously you're from here."
Yeah,
I said, "Well, no, I'm not." He goes, "Where are you from?" I said, "Kentucky." "You're from Kentucky?" Long story short, I got hired to coach dialect on the movie, and then I wasn't in the union, and I knew they were all big basketball nuts, so I organized this weekend basketball game,
right.
pickup game, and I kept bugging them, "Hey, give me my SAG card, give me in the union," and they did. So, yeah, that was my very first film in 1990.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing. Well, I mean, for you horror fans out there, you'll know that you have a long history with Wes Craven.
Wes, yeah.
This is Kenny Jones from Scream.
Kenny from Scream, man. Yeah. I mean, but it began with New Nightmare.
Yeah. Right?
Most people are thinking Vampire in Brooklyn, probably. Like, just most, you know.
See, if Vampire in Brooklyn hadn't have happened, Scream wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true. Because
he said when we started at our meeting, I think it was a party at his house, but he spoke, he said, "Look, I learned a valuable lesson on my last project. If this movie is not scary, it will not be funny. We are making a satire of this genre. However, never fall into thinking that we're making a joke about it."
That's a great point.
And that's really kind of what happened. I don't think – I mean, it's been a long time since I've watched it. But, you know, Vampire in Brooklyn wasn't the greatest.
Yeah.
But I've been in worse.
So let's talk about those.
Well, I mean, in our time hanging out, you have so many great stories. And you speak so kindly of Wes. And you always had great stories to the documentary. But how did it – for the horror listeners out there, let's talk about how you got into New Nightmare, your first encounter with Wes.
Well, I came out here. I'd kind of hit the glass ceiling in Chicago.
Yeah.
And so my agents, they'd send about half dozen folks out here. So I came out and I got a TV pilot. I've been here 2 weeks. And then I shot that in New Orleans, came back, got a TV movie. And I called my wife and I said, "We have to move out here because this is low-hanging fruit."
Yeah.
So we move. The pilot doesn't get picked up. And suddenly I'm no longer the Chicago theater guy.
Yeah.
I'm just another schlub. And it was 7 months of nothing, which was the longest I'd ever gone. And that was scary. And Gary Zuckerbrod cast the pilot, and I got a call. They said, "You know, Gary wants to bring you in. There's a new Wes Craven film that he's doing, and he wants you to come in. The script is not available. You have to go in and read the script." So at that point, I didn't know that Wes – because I thought the first – it's still think the first Nightmare is one of my favorite all-time films.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a brilliant, smart film about something.
Yeah.
And then – you know, Freddy quickly degenerated into a fun movie, but not what Freddy Krueger was initially intended to be.
Completely.
Well, I didn't know that Wes didn't really have a hand in making them.
Right.
So I go there and it says Nightmare 7 on the door. And I'm like, oh.
That was a facepalm for those.
Oh, yeah. So I went in And I read the script there in the office right before the audition.
Oh, wow.
And it, I mean, you know the film. It was the first meta film that I'd really encountered, yeah, a movie about itself in real time as the story unfolded. And I thought it was ingenious.
Yeah.
How to reinvigorate this character in this world. So I had an audition. It was, yeah, so-so. But I got cast. And it was – we were shooting – I mean, I'm the morgue attendant.
Right.
It's one nice scene with, yeah, Heather. And we were shooting at a hotel – or hotel hospital here in Silver Lake. And we were done at like 4 in the morning. I'm signing out. I'm in the honey wagon. You know, I'm changing clothes. And there's a knock on my door. And I'm like, oh, it's Wes.
Yeah.
And he said, I just want to – yeah. Gary really pushed for me to hire you, and I'm so glad he did. Let's stay in touch. So he gave me his phone number.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the beginning of a friendship that, you know, evolved into Scream. And we stayed in touch, you know, for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And did you, when Scream came about, did you have to audition for Wes or any producers? Or
no.
Was it just a...
Oh, it was an
just called you. Yeah.
With Vampire in Brooklyn... I was pushing. I was with a small agency.
Oh, yeah, Vampire Brooklyn
yeah, came between
right,
those
yes,
two.
Yes, yes, yes.
And again, he'd given me his number. I felt presumptuous.
Right.
I don't know that I'd ever called him. Maybe I did. I don't remember. But it was with Vampire in Brooklyn. I kept pushing my agents. I said, get me in on this. Well, there was a role. It was like a one-line role, literally a day player one-liner. I walked in. It was at the Roddenberry Building at Paramount. And as soon as I walked in the door, I heard him turn to Marianne, and he went, oh, my God, why didn't we have him here earlier? So then one actor got ill, actually, and they had to move some cast around. So I got bumped up to a little bit bigger role. Mm. But that was a really difficult – because there was an accident on set.
Stunt accident.
Yes, and that happened the day before I started.
Oh.
And so that was
tough.
But it was after that that I took him up and did call him, and
right,
and we stayed in touch.
That's great.
So Scream just was kind of came to me.
Yeah.
What was the prep for Scream like? Like, did he realize kind of that he was reinventing the genre within that?
You know, I had heard the buzz on the script, and it, which was intense, and I read it. To be honest, upon first read, I'm like, all I grew up watching, Kevin and I are the same age. Like, okay, I get the touchstones that he's, you know, I saw the original Scream, you know, in 1980.
Yeah.
But it was called Scary Movie, you know, that. It wasn't
right,
Scream.
Yeah, right.
I didn't get it. I mean, I thought, well, it makes sense. All the plot points line up, which wasn't necessarily the case in these movies. But the whole commentary and satire really didn't register with me until we started to do it. And then when I saw that first, you know, 10-minute segment with Drew, and because that's like a classic movie scene of not only the genre but movies, period, I started to see what he was aiming at and see how it all worked.
Nice.
But still, I was still blown away. But that and Something About Mary both. I really did not know as we were doing it that they were going to be anything extraordinary. Until I saw the finished product. And when I saw the finished product, I realized how stupid and wrong I had been.
What was Wes's demeanor like on set? Was he like super high energy or pretty chill?
He's like your absolute favorite college professor. You know, he would come, his way of working with actors, he would just come up and he would kind of whisper in your ear, okay, when this happens, think about what she says to you. Remember that scene we did last week? Think about that. I'm just going to let that be the subtext of this. And he worked that way with everybody. And he was very, very protective of, I mean, especially I remember with Drew and those scenes where you're very, very vulnerable. He was very protective of his actors. So I couldn't say enough great things about the man, and I miss him. I wish he were still around.
Yeah, he is definitely missed. So in terms of keeping it within the genre, and then Elric, we can go into Deadwood as much as you want. Yeah. But you know, what I've discovered is you're definitely a genre fan as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, how far back does horror reach for you in terms of the love for the genre?
My whole career, the whole path of my life, The seeds were planted the summer before my freshman year of high school and the summer afterwards. Three movies came out that mesmerized me. That I, back in my day, when you wanted to see a movie, by God, you had to go to the theater. We didn't have your fancy videotapes and everything.
This is the second time we get like an old man.
I was going to say, he should have done Berserker.
Yeah.
So, it was Animal House, Halloween, and Star Wars.
Yeah. Nice.
And those were the films that I saw multiple times. And the films that, listen, because the first Star Wars, Daytona Beach, Florida, on Christmas or summer vacation with my family. And I convinced my mom to take me and my buddy and drop us off at the mall because I'd heard people talking about it. That initial scene coming over.
Yeah.
You know,
I still can't believe those are models. When I watch that now, I'm like, wow.
Well, that the scene in Animal House where Belushi pours the mustard on himself, and the scene in Halloween when Michael Myers sits up behind her.
Oh, yeah.
I recently saw, you've probably seen it too, it's going around the internet, there was a film of the audience watching the original Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
It's like night vision.
Mm, yeah.
And I'm like, I was that. I was. So that's what really planted the seed of me seeing every horror movie.
Yeah.
And I loved every one of them. You know, every sci-fi movie that followed Star Wars, I didn't particularly care for Flash Gordon.
Right.
What? Sacrilege.
Mike Hodges' second mention of the show.
But yeah, those were the big three. So and
they become the linchpin of all three of those genres for the next 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those three are the archetypes, which is hard to believe.
Yeah.
That's kind and that you're there for ground zero of all three.
And what's really hard to believe when people hire you and you're a boss and they say, oh, man, something about Mary, which Seth Rogen said, something about Mary was like that for me and Evan.
No, that's like, I believe that, yeah.
Thanks. And I know you've said Scream was what got you in the movies.
Oh, yeah. Once, I mean, like when there was just the turning point when I was in film school that just kind of solidified.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm on the right path and this is the like movies like this. So the reason, and I wanted to be Kevin Williamson when I grew up.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, I think that thing, you know, what Wes always said about horror.
I don't know about that.
And that was absolutely the appeal to me at that point in my life. You know, you're coming to terms with your own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
As a teenager is when you start to realize, oh, hey, I'm not going to last forever. And that the films gave you a way to approach that fear, that primal fear that you had, and to realize I can control my fear. You know, my fear is not in control of me.
Right,
and it's a shared experience. I heard you guys talking earlier about, you know, the theatrical experience. And that's why I especially love horror movies, in good ones, in the theater, because there is that Halloween in 1978 when the whole audience is in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Last time I felt that, I think it was towards, Hereditary had it, but like there was toward when you're getting towards the end of Get Out. And when you didn't know what's going to happen and you get everyone is worried for this guy. And that's an amazing feeling when everyone is on edge because they don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I remember gasps in Hereditary. That was a really good theatrical experience.
See, I haven't watched it yet. I saw Midsommar. It creeped me out for like 2 or 3 days.
Hereditary is darker and more disturbing.
Hereditary is even,
I think it'll mess with you. And it's cool that horror films still getting made that feel dangerous and, you know, unpredictable in that way.
Yeah.
I'm curious, just like flicking over, because like you've been in so many great TV shows as well, like playing characters for, you know, more than a year, you know, True Detective season 2 as well.
Mm-hmm.
But like, what's the darkest, because I don't know, have you ever played, we're talking about horror films, have you ever played a character who, you know, is one of these kind of killer dark beings? Because obviously you look like someone who we could get cast very easily in that way, or almost typecast, but you've also played so many gray area characters. Which
I did on X-Files. A different actor committed the actual murders, but the idea was it was my character. He'd gotten out of prison and she was taking care of him, thinking he was an innocent man. He was released because the DNA and the evidence that were on the case, that's what broke it. Like, it's not him. It's not his DNA. So he was released. Well, the idea is the character literally becomes another person as he commits the murder. And then there was, let's see, oh, God, what was the name of it, where I killed a bunch of people. And I wanted to kill my mama, but I couldn't face that. So, it was one of the crime procedural shows. So yeah, I've played.
See, I've had to do that. I just am always curious to be like when you because we have watched these movies, but I always am curious about the actor process, how dark. And obviously, we're off mic talking about Joaquin and The Master, which you were in the scene, but like how much you have to go there in your method.
Yeah, Nine Inch Nails fixed EP. Pretty much takes me there.
Nice.
One good track. Well, Fist Fuck, the song Fist Fuck, that whole that primal drumming section in the middle. No, man, it's something Pavlovian.
I saw that live. It was amazing.
I've seen him do it, too.
Yeah. I just read, you're Keith Summers in Bates Motel is a pretty gnarly character.
That's right, yeah. I know that one,
You realize that
And that's
you.
Only two scenes. Yeah. But that whole first, the first six episodes of that were the Keith Summers arc.
Yeah.
And my daughter, it's just a funny story aside to that. My kid's never, you know, she's grown up around this. My wife and I, she's from Murray also. My wife is my high school sweetheart. And all of her, we're the only ones in our family to ever leave.
Yeah.
And so, but my kid's grown up here in Burbank. And most of our friends are in the music or film industry. So it's nothing big deal to her. And she was completely unimpressed by anything I've ever done. And she came home from school. It was her freshman year. And she goes, well, I have to hand it to you. I said, what? She goes, you've made me quite popular in the halls of my high school.
Oh, no.
I said, really? She goes, oh, yeah. All day long, I've heard whispered behind me, that's the rapist's daughter.
Oh, my God.
That's the rapist. So,
wow. God.
That's pretty great.
Well, that does set Bates Motel in motion. So you were the reason that whole five seasons happened.
See, that's a show, and my wife teases me about it. I was up there doing a show for DirecTV. Title escapes me at the moment. But they were doing Bates on the adjoining soundstage.
Yeah.
When they announced Bates Motel, I read it in the trades, and I said out loud to my wife, I went, they're doing – prequel to Psycho set in the current day. That's the worst idea for a show I've ever heard. Another example of me being
said that.
Well, they called and Deadwood, and I think Carlton was a big fan of Deadwood, and they said, here's this thing they want you. And so I read the script in the same way with New Nightmare of, oh wow, this is awesome. And so they wanted me to take a selfie to see what my facial hair and everything was. And I mean, I'm literally in my production trailer. They're across the parking lot. I said, well, fuck, I'll solve that. So I just walked over and I walked in and Carlton, I saw him wheel out of his office into the hallway and he went, I just hung up with your agent 5 minutes ago. Do you live here? Said, no. So anyway, great show and I'm very proud to be part of it because I thought it was extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah, and you also worked with Joe Lynch.
Joe, I just noticed that.
Yeah. Knights of Badassdom.
Wow. Joe's great.
Have you seen the original cut of that?
We would love to.
We wish we could.
Does he have what?
Joe, if you're listening.
He does listen.
Hang on. We're just going to we're gonna lob a message over to Movie Crypt. Movie Crypt.
Movie Crypt. We want to see that.
We want to see the original cut.
I'm sending a carrier pigeon right now.
The final movie's not bad at all. I rather enjoy it, but I'm sure that whatever
But I mean, I know what happened in that process. And you know, and I know it. I wasn't there, but I know the buzz at Comic-Con was over the moon about it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the little unknown movie that everybody was talking about, and then it doesn't get released for 2.5 years because of. So, yeah, it was. Yeah. That's why I wish I could see the original version.
Yeah. What is Project Elf?
That's an Elf TV movie. Oh, Project Alf.
Project
Alf.
Alf.
Is this is in like the lovable alien from Melmac?
Alf. That's right.
The movie.
Oh my gosh.
Wait, but what was it on the – I don't remember in my Alf knowledge.
It was about 4 or 5 years after the TV show ended.
And the TV show ended when he was like – I thought like he got dissected, didn't he?
It was the most depressing ending ever.
He got taken, but he never got dissected.
But that was the we thought as kids. Wait, they're going to experiment on it.
It did not compare to the fucking Elf Christmas episode, which – did you guys see it?
No, I stopped watching Elf at a certain point, and then kids came into school and said Elf got dissected in the finale, and I was like, oh, my God.
Kids are so cruel.
So the Christmas episode of Elf, he counseled a man who was Santa off a bridge as he was trying to kill himself, and then he ended up counseling a little girl who was dying of leukemia, and it ends with Alf driving off with the family as you know she has days to live. Fuck, well, Merry Christmas!
Darts, wow. A happy one.
Well, yeah. If anybody wants to catch up on ALF, A-L-F, it's on Hulu.
And then he sang that great rock really? Song.
Well, yeah, he would play the guitar. World. He would eat. He would eat cats. You know, all that kind of shit.
Yeah, it was a good one. What was Project ALF?
It was a TV movie. You know, I remember playing a truck driver and shot it at the Pink Motel. That's really about all I remember.
So it actually seems like it's a continuation. Captured by the alien passport, ALF is rescued by two officers who find out that the project's canceled because we had to save ALF.
Yeah. Well, to stay on hard.
Is there a happy ending ALF that we never knew about?
You know what?
It was zombie ALF.
I think it's time for an ALF reboot. I mean, like, just like put a happy spin on it. You know, there's other we can talk about other like genre films that you kind of peppered throughout your career. Lost Souls with Winona Ryder.
But that one's I am a little curious about that because
why are you curious?
Okay, because Janusz Kaminski is one of the greatest cinematographers of all time. It's the only film he ever directed.
Yeah,
And he's Spielberg's cinematographer.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
I did not
know that. No, I remember at the time. That's actually why I went. I would have gone anyway because it was a horror film, but I remember going, Janusz shot this. Yeah. And I was, if you haven't seen Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which he shot, you know, way later, it's like one of the best visual films ever made. But what was that like? Because that's obviously, I think some DPs have different maybe ways of communicating.
I mean, to be honest, I don't have a lot of specific memories. I remember we were shooting at a church downtown. So I got shot through. I do have a funny story in relation.
Oh, then let's just go to that.
Something About Mary was still in theaters. And this was like, because it ran forever in theaters. And we had this big church. We got like 400 extras. And I get shot through the eyeball. And the effects house. Stan Winston. You know, that was cool because I got to go to Stan Winston and get molded and see the monsters and all that stuff. So we'd spent the day shooting this, and I'm in the van because I couldn't park at base camp. So I'm in the van with the extras. Well, there's these two budding young actors, you know, they know just fresh to the city, and they're here, this guy and this girl, and they're talking about something about Mary. And I'm literally sitting next. The girl's sitting next to me. I'm like, oh, my God, that's the funniest movie ever. Oh, the brother. Oh, my God. How about that scene? And I think, it's obviously because, you know, I'm here. And I said, so, you guys enjoy that film? Oh, my God, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen. It's so funny. Have you seen it? I said, well, I am Warren. I am the brother. She literally gives me the once over. Eye up, eye down, and turns her back to me.
Oh, wow.
Like, okay, we just spent a day watching me get shot in the eyeball. So, okay, so. And then my second thought was, wait a minute. She absolutely believes the character so much, she thinks I'm trying to mack on her and scam her by lying.
Wow.
So yeah.
Wow, what a weird reaction.
Said pork to beans.
Yeah.
Like, find her.
That's really cool.
Since we're on there, you know, we had Lynn Shea on, I think, at the beginning of this year, and we love Lynn, obviously. Yeah, yeah.
That's how I got Something About Mary.
Really? So I want to ask that question because I thought her history with the Farley brothers, which wasn't as simple as, this gal's great, we should use her in all these movies. She, like, fought hard for, I think, Kingpin. She was telling us the whole story.
Yeah.
What was your experience with the Farley brothers, and in particular, now that there's a Lynn connection, what's that story?
The way it came about, I was doing a miniseries for CBS called Bella Mafia, which it was a little overwritten melodrama. And Jennifer Tilly and I played husband and wife, and we had a sex scene, and we kind of made it funny. And Gary Yoshiba was a camera assistant on it. And he had shot the Wes Craven films with Mark Irwin. He was Mark's first.
Yeah.
And he was on B camera for this miniseries, just hiring out. Well, Jen and I just goof it, and it's funny. And the director liked it. And so we finished, and Mark goes – Gary says, oh, my God, I've never seen you do comedy. That you're funny. Dude, you're funny. We're going to be doing this new Farrelly Brothers movie. It's called Something About Mary. It's the funniest script I've ever read. The very next day, I'm at the Bally's Health Club in Studio City on the Stairmaster next to Lynn Shea.
Wow.
And we had never met. I mean, we'd been in the West films, and I said, we have a mutual friend, Wes Craven. Oh, yeah, blah, blah, Wes is talking about Wes and, you know, actors. What are you doing now? I'm doing this. I said, what about you? She goes, well, I'm about to start this Farrelly Brother. Did you see Kingpin? I said, oh, yeah. It's the funniest script I've ever read in my life. It's called There's Something About Mary. So two people in the course of 2 days have mentioned a project I've never heard of.
Yeah.
So I was with a smaller agency then. They couldn't get me in the door. I was part of an improv group that met at Amy Pietz's house. And we weren't creating a show or creating a company. It was just working actors who liked to get together and play. Well, Rob Moran was part of it. And I kept thinking, where do I know this dude? I don't – Chicago. Most of us were Chicago. Well, then I rewatched Kingpin. He's Stanley the Evil Bowler.
Oh. Yeah.
So the next weekend, I went, dude, I finally placed it. You're Stanley the Evil Bowler. He went, yeah, yeah. And I'm the bartender in Dumb and Dumber when Jim gets stood That's up right. on the date. I said, yeah. I said, so you know the Farrelly brothers? He goes, oh, I grew up with them. I'm from Rhode Island. I've known them since I was a teenager. I said, man, I'm trying to get in the door on this new film of theirs, something about Warren, the role of Warren, because they can't find anybody. They've seen dozens of people. I said, well, I'm going to have dinner with Bobby tonight. So he calls me and he goes, Tuesday. They want to see you Tuesday. I was the only guy that played it straight. They were bringing in comics who were trying to goof it and make it farcical. Right. And I just knew instinctively the only way to make that funny is to make it honest. Because if you yuck it up, you know, the audience is A, going to hate you, and B, it ain't going to be funny.
Yeah.
So I think out of all of that, you know, I was the only person and I got it. So
amazing. And how did I mean, like, fun. just in general, I mean, like, that was such a, I mean, like, even for Lynn, like, it felt like every turn in that movie just set everybody, skyrocketed.
Well,
everybody.
I said to when it finished, I said, congratulations, you're no longer Bob's sister. Because she'd been in all the New Line films, because she's Bob's sister.
Yeah.
And she's all, I mean, she was extraordinarily talented. Yeah. But with that film, she was so damn good and so funny. That it, she was really with Kingpin too, but Kingpin wasn't the huge hit that, you know, Mary became.
Right, right.
But Mary's, you know.
Insane.
Yep.
Can we talk about American Shakespeare?
Sure.
So American Shakespeare, which is as close as America will ever get to Shakespeare, which is Deadwood, reading that pilot, what was, I mean, it really is, right?
Yeah, I'm wrong. It's
and all the actors. When you look at those people in a room and, you know, Ian McShane, when you see what he did with that role, like people where I was raised in New Zealand, Lovejoy was still kind of playing. He's kind of like this romantic lead in a sense. Obviously, Sexy Beast years later, he's unbelievably great.
That's what led to him getting Deadwood with Sexy Beast.
That makes sense because that he's just incredible in that film. But just walk us through how you got that. And because I would imagine on page, I'm sure it reads well, but I could also imagine people going, oh, Western, how's this going to play?
Well, what happened was I was sent, I had done guest star on 6 Feet Under. And a lot of us had. And it was the same production people.
Also one of the other best shows, I think.
Yeah, same casting people. And so this comes around. I had committed to doing a play. Steve Earle, the songwriter. I was a rabid. I found Copperhead Road when I was in grad school, and I was just learning to play guitar. And a rabid, like collecting bootleg Steve Earle fan. And then I met him at an airport, and we became good friends. And he wrote this role in this play, his first play, Carla, about Carla Faye Tucker. And we're producing it in Nashville, and he asked me to play this part. Yes, I'll do it. Well, then Deadwood rolls around. So they sent me the script, and I knew immediately upon reading, like, this is like nothing I've seen. But Doherty, there was only like 4 lines or 5 lines in the pilot. And I said to my agents, I said, look, I have no interest in being the thug in the shadows for 7 years. I really don't. I said, you know what? But they really want you in this. I said, well, what about Jack McCall, the guy that kills Hickok? There's only 4 episodes. I said, I don't give a shit. It's something fun, something to play. So I went in, and it was Junie and Libby, Junie Lowry Johnson and Libby Goldstein. So Libby comes out, and she goes, all right, well, you've got Doherty. I said, yeah, but I want to do McCall. What? I said, I want to do McCall. Do you have both of them? I said, okay. So we go in, and it's Walter Hill and David. I had guest starred on NYPD Blue, and I had met David in passing, but I didn't know him, you know, the mad genius. So we did McCall, and he kind of looks over at her, like, because he's expecting Doherty. And she goes, we have Doherty. Let's do the Doherty. I said, all right. So we do it, and David scoots to the edge of the couch. He goes, all right, we're going to do this again. Okay, now I want you to think about this. Now, the reason that there's a comma in that first sentence, now the reason for that, he parses every word, and every syllable of a word carried weight. And that's why I realized, like, oh, shit, this guy doesn't write Thugs and Shadows. There are no periphery scene-dressing characters. Everything. So that's when I got excited about it. Well, I was committed to the play, And it came down, it was Halloween, actually, of 2002. And they had to have me out here to shoot, and I was had a play performance. So Steve was on the – I was on the phone. He was there, and he could hear my phone conversation. They said, look, if you can't work on that date, it's a drop dead. They're going to have to move on and get someone else because they can't accommodate it. So hang up. Steve goes, hey, man. I said, look, I promised you 2 years ago I'd do this. I'm not dropping out of this. He goes, yeah, but I'm going to feel like shit if I cost you a TV show. Long story, we worked it out. We canceled the one performance. I literally flew here. He picked me up at the airport. We drove right to the theater. I changed clothes and walked on stage. Wow. It all worked out. Mm. And then, you know, his involvement with the show, they wanted a theme song, HBO did, and they wanted him to write it. And then Milch couldn't really turn loose of any words that he didn't control. So Steve was willing to work with David because I put the two of them together and we met. Hooplehead Steve is actually based – it was originally intended to be Steve Earle for just an episode or two. And then, you know, Michael Harney knocked it out of the park. He was in the whole series. But yeah, that was – it just kind of fell in my lap. Another one, I knew reading the script, I knew it was unique. And I knew it was unlike anything that had really been done before. But the experience of doing that, my God, it was transcendent. It was
– but just all the level of – I just imagine it's one of those jobs everyone went to work going, we all want to raise our level.
Couldn't wait to get there.
It's like the most heavyweight show I've ever seen in that sense.
I joined the writing staff in season two when Ricky Jay left. David had invited me, so I was on the staff for two and three. So I was there every day, like every day. Wow. And you couldn't wait to get to work because you didn't know what was going to happen. And David would be writing today what we're going to shoot tomorrow.
Right.
So there was that thrill of, you know, coming in just under the line. And it's not like every day were big hugs and butterfly kisses, because there were days we were at each other's throats. Mm. And there were days, you know, of David – said, you always check to see if the shadows were whispering to Dave, you know, and if they were, stay the fuck away. But we all knew that at the end of the day, we were doing something no one had seen, and we were all committed. And Sean Bridgers said at the end of the first season, we were starting the second season, he said, man, I tell you, last season, I was down on myself because I realized I was batting ninth in the order, and I've never batted ninth in the order at anything I've ever done. Sports, theater, nothing. I've never batted ninth. And then I watched the show and I realized, yeah, I'm batting ninth in the order on the 27 Yankees.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was what it was like.
Yeah.
And when it didn't end, it stopped.
Yeah.
And I could not accept that. And I hung on it to, you know, took me about 5 years to quit beating the dead horse. And I finally let it go, like, this is never going to happen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 1 year ago, we were doing it. And my relationship to it has completely changed. To have that moment that we could all reconvene, share a moment, and say goodbye to each other and say goodbye to Dave. Because, you know, he has Alzheimer's. It's not a secret.
Yeah.
And
that's a legacy. I mean, you guys have left. I view that and Sopranos as these two shows that are will never be repeated. And they're both in genres that people think of like antiquated. They're not relevant anymore. They made it relevant to now. Mm-hmm. They made it tie into, like I say, it's like Shakespearean, watching these real actors communicate something that's really touching. I actually went to Deadwood not long ago for the first time. I was just passing through. And all you know, it was kind of an amazing experience to go to the real Deadwood, which has a little bit of stuff you might feel like you recognize. You know, Al Swearengen, there's a real bar there that Swearengen really started, which is pretty remarkable.
And I said, you can feel the ghosts. I haven't seen them. I went up to the Bullock Suite once. There's some folks staying there, and they recognize me. They're like, hey, man, we're in the Bullock Suite. You want to come and have a drink? man. I want to see the ghost. I didn't see him, but
but those are the American stories. Like, the West is the American story. You know, it's the one genre that only America can lay claim to, and that is, to me, the defining work now. So
it's kind of an inversion of – this was early second season. Some Dave were talking about – I said, our Western. We're not doing Western. This is on set as this conversation is happening. I said, well, huh? He goes, no, your archetypical American Western, of which I was never a fucking fan of, was basically a justification for Manifest Destiny. It was the lies that we told ourselves, you know, to salve the fact of the savageries that we had pulled upon indigenous peoples. And it's about individualism in the great wide expanses. I was never a fan of those fucking movies. Our show's the exact opposite. It's about how we as a humans tend to cleave together and form a community out of chaos. And that's how we need one another. And I said, well, yeah, but Dave, I'm wearing boots and a six shooter. It's a fucking Western.
That's great.
What were some of those missed opportunities? I'm sure that there are some projects, you know. Acting.
Things that I wanted and didn't
things
get?
That you really, really wanted.
I don't want to talk about
all
those.
All right.
You know, it's.
I'm always curious.
You know, there's been a handful of things that I really wanted to be a part of.
Right.
And some have been successful and some, you know, came and went and disappeared.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I don't want to deride because I know people, you know, mm-hmm. I used to lose,
sure.
You know, guest star stuff to Jim Gandolfini and Jack Black a lot.
Yeah.
You know,
What are the bigger surprises of the work that you've done that got way more attention than you thought, on top of things like There's Something About Mary?
Mary and Scream were the two because they really kind of changed. You know, you mentioned tired genres or whatnot, but I think there's validity in all stories.
Yeah.
And every now and again, there's going to be Get Out, completely reinvigorated horror.
Mm-hmm.
You know, post that, Scream completely reinvigorated horror, specifically slasher films. Because no one made them. I mean, they were just, you know, knockoff films, you know, drive-in movie theaters.
Yeah.
So there's always going to be – I'm looking forward to the next Western that really, really knocks it out of the park. So we'll have another spate of them.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard Quentin, hopefully, he's going to do that Bounty Law as a TV series.
Yeah.
So I want to be in that.
Yeah.
What I love is the scenes where they're acting in that movie where you start to forget you're watching once upon a time. You think you're watching a Western for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And your brain's like, oh, shit, I was getting so into
that.
You
know, that's actually my favorite moment when he flubs the line.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's right. They're making a show.
with your co-star,
so
Timothy Oliphant, right? And who's also in Scream 2.
It's all connected.
Oh, yeah.
I had an actor question. I mean, obviously, you've done movies and TV shows, and I'm just curious from your perspective, the differences between the two, which ones you prefer, because obviously when you're on a TV show, you get to reprise a character over and over and over again. Like, how is that process different for you than just, you know, coming in and doing a movie and happening a character there?
Creatively, I don't really – you know, I still get asked that question of young actors, the difference between theater acting and camera acting. There is no difference. I mean, there's different craft things.
Sure.
On stage, you got to make sure the audience can see you and hear you. You got to project to the back row. Whereas on camera, the frame is right there. It sees what's happening behind your eyes, and the microphone hears you breathing. So you don't have to worry about those things. And on camera, okay, I got to hit my mark and fill the frame, what the director needs. Those are craft things. Either the moment is alive, you know, that there's an energy that happens in communication between people. Either it's there or it isn't. For me, it's all about the writing. I don't care if it's a TV show or a movie, or if it's great writing, if it's a great show that when I've finished, that if I find myself proud of it, then that's all I care. Yeah.
Do you miss the rush of theater? Because like I started my career doing theater, and you will spend months prepping for one night or a couple of nights. And then it's all about having 2 hours of perfection. And there's like this rush that goes along with it.
Well, on camera, a great DP and a great editor with guidance from a director can make anybody into a decent film actor. Mm-hmm. On stage, it's you and the audience. There is no buffer, you know. And now you get more of a time to build something. You get a long rehearsal period that you generally don't get in film. But yeah, there's an immediacy because that energy I talked about between actors also happens with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they're there in the moment with you, there's an energy coming off of them that feeds you, and it becomes this loop, you know, that because it's live and in the moment. You can still get it from a film. Like I've slipped in. There's a few films I did that were relatively successful. I'd slip in and watch the audience watch the movie, you know. And that's what I said. That's back to that communal experience.
Yeah.
But as the performer, as the artist creating it, it's not immediate for you. So you're removed. So how did I solve that? I started a band and I play music live.
Oh, see, that's nice. Because I'm always like, I love working in film so much, yeah. but there are so many times where I'm like, you know what I miss? I miss that backstage, yeah. like, holy shit, did you hear how they were laughing at that yeah. scene? Like, there's something about it that we mm-hmm. don't get.
And it, again, I do literally get that from playing with Sacred Cowboys.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
What type of music is Sacred Cowboys? Yeah.
I love, the same way about movies, I love all kind of music. Well, Americana, if you had to slap a label mm-hmm. on it, it's country music with really loud AC/DC guitars.
Nice.
Nice.
That's outlawish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. that's fun. I mean, we cover, it's mostly original music. My favorite, and I got in a big argument with one of my bandmates over this, because we reconvened a year ago, because we were an active band from 05 to, we played Stagecoach in 09.
Hmm. Oh, wow.
And the Zac Brown Band played before us.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were kind of at the point of like, oh shit, this is kind of real. Mm-hmm. I can't afford to quit my day job and get in a white van. Right. So anyway, a year or so ago, we put it all back together. But I wanted to cover Thin Lizzy's Cowboy Song.
Nice.
But at the end, we break into My Heroes Have Always Been Cowboys. And then we break into Cowboys from Hell. And then we break into Happy Trails. And then when it comes to that the guitar harmony part that they play, that's where we bring those songs in. And then we come back into the harmony. And putting it together with the band was a big knockdown drag out. And it works like a fucking dream. Ralph, I was right, man.
Because Ralph listens to yeah. the show. He heard you.
Yeah, well, now. Well, thank you so much for coming sure, on,
thank
man.
Thank you so much.
This is a good check, Earl Brown, in Reprisal, December 6th on Hulu.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll be talking about it on the show later on as well. Very yeah. excited. But, dude, thanks
for having
on.
Me. Thank I really
you
appreciate
so
it.
Much. Yeah.
Thanks, man.
So we are off next week for Thanksgiving.
That's right.
And we will be back
Blood
the
Rage
following.
And then come back.
Watch Blood Rage.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Happy Thanksgiving.
All right, see you.